Good afternoon. Chapter 2. I just discovered Buddhism. I was still at University of Oregon, and that second school year I lived with Jim, who had been my closest high school training partner. We were both struggling architecture students, saddled with very heavy workloads. In between all-night stints in the drafting studio, I would try to keep training. It sort of went like 2 weeks and not much running, and then bear down and intensive training for 2 weeks, and then, oh no, I'd freak out and have to deal with school and go back to another couple weeks of intensive drafting. Jim and I were very close, born from those hard afternoons churning out interval workouts on the track, side by side, one just a stride ahead of the other, needing each other to help face the challenge laid down by each workout, the place near the end where you had to muster up what was needed to really do what you knew needed to be done, but which your mind and body protested against. But also born from those lazy off-day runs into the East Hills to search out whatever new creations in residential architecture we could find and to marvel at houses. In each fall, just when we thought the leaves may be at their peak, Jim and I would always be sure to take a run under three particular majestic maples on Fairmont Boulevard and feel the golden light coming down through their leaves. One dark, rainy night, about 9 o'clock, I put on my all-black rain suit and said to Jim, I'm going out for 10. In the dark, on the far side of one of the footbridges crossing the river, I fell and severely sprained my ankle. I couldn't put any weight on it and had to hop and crawl back until I could cross the railroad tracks and get up through the backyards to my mom's house. That was 2 weeks on crutches. And from then on, I would repeatedly re-hurt the same ankle every so often for the next 4 years or so, perhaps a dozen times on crutches. I took a course that year from a guy I had taken a yoga classes from, named Brian, just a year or two older than me, who had spent the previous summer living on a yoga ashram. It was called Yogic Vedantic Philosophy, and we studied the Vedas, the Upanishads, the aphorisms of Patanjali, the Bhagavad Gita, the Dharmapada, and all sorts of stuff. We used Sarvapalli Radhakrishna's source book in Indian philosophy as our text. So after this, I had a pretty solid introduction to all the history of Indian thought leading up to Buddhism. For spring break, I went on a road trip with some friends. I was sort of along for the ride. Other people had already made connections with various places along the way. Playing hacky sack one morning in People's Park in Berkeley, someone said there was a place we were going to that evening. Fine by me, whatever. We arrived somewhere north of the bay after nightfall, late-ish. Someone met us at the gate and led our car to a nearby meadow where we set up our tents and sacked out. The next morning, I got up before everyone else, even though it was probably almost 9. I wandered on down the road farther into the place we were at. Soon, I came upon a collection of Japanese-style buildings, all connected by little walkways. Walking through the outdoor areas, there was no one around. The place seemed deserted. I came to one large building with a big wooden door that was ajar. I slipped inside onto the highly polished wood floors. Another large doorway was to my right, and stepping to the entrance, I looked inside. A vast, dark meditation hall was laid out in front of me, formal rows of cushions set up on tawn platforms around the perimeter, perhaps 100 seats, not a person in sight. I thought, hey, I know what this is. It was Green Gulch. We only spent a few hours there, walking around the gardens, meeting a few people, and then had to get back on the road. Little did I know the kind of time I would be spending there in years to come. Summer came, and unemployment was staggeringly high. I remember responding to an ad to be a gas station attendant and finding an hour before the time stated in the ad to show up, a line stretching around the block just to fill out the standard one-page application that they ripped off a pad of applications. But Matt and I still had plans to drop out and go bicycle touring. So over the summer, we managed to scrape together little moments of employment here and there and get a little money. It was the summer of 1980, and time for the Olympic trials to descend upon Eugene again. With almost no money, I could not afford tickets, but my brother had budgeted enough to get a set for himself for the 10 days. Using his tickets as a model, I went to the art store, spent a little bit on a bunch of supplies, and sat down at home and forged two complete sets of tickets to the trials. Each day I would invite either Matt or Jim to come along. The nerve-wracking moment was handing the ticket to be ripped. The perforations had to feel right when they tore. And of course, we didn't actually have seats, so we would sit wherever, and when someone came to say, "Hey, that's my seat," we'd say, "Oh, guess we're in the wrong spot." Soon we noticed that they had neglected to sell any seats to the old president's box right in the middle of the east grandstand, so we just went to sit there with others who had figured out the same thing and were looking for elbow room. One day in the east grandstands, Jeff introduced me to Willie Williams, the head coach at University of Arizona. Willie was one of the first African-American head coaches in NCAA track. He was the picture of relaxation, sprawled across the wooden benches in the sun. I saw a couple of Arizona runners down on the track warming up for their heats, and I said, "Looks like you've got a couple runners down there. Aren't you nervous?" And he said, "I've done my work. It's up to them now." Willie had grown up in Compton in South Central LA, and he kept in touch with that community there. He'd been one of the nation's best sprinters in the early 60s. Willie was known for bringing talented but underprivileged guys out of the ghetto and showing them that they too could be something. Those two runners down there competing for places on the U.S. Olympic team were athletes that, except for the guidance of Willie, could have easily been trapped in lives of gang warfare back home. So it was the final event of the final day of the 1980 trials, the men's 5,000 meters, a race many remember as the greatest that ever was at Hayward Field. The first three finishers in each event at the trials become the Olympic team for that event, so the stakes were as high as they could be. That year, of course, there was the controversy of Carter's Olympic boycott. A popular t-shirt on sale at the track showed caricatures of all the expected finalists of the men's 5,000 in expected order of finish, storming around the curve, Centrowitz, Salazar, Chapa, Berkeley, Rojas, Bjorklund, Wells, etc. And coming in the wrong direction into a head-on collision was Jimmy Carter, a well-known jogger in his own right, in his characteristic headband. The top of the shirt had five crumbling donuts making up the Olympic rings and the words "Olympic Trials and Tribulations." So, despite politics, there was a definite atmosphere of defiance in the air that this race was still going to be a gauntlet throwdown type of affair nonetheless. And stepping to the line with the finalists for the starting gun was Billy. Jim and I were amazed. I guess we had not been paying attention earlier in the week through the qualifying rounds, but we had been unaware Billy had made it. His season had not gone well, and he'd been injury-plagued. But secretly, he'd been training in the pool, low-impact work, and had been coming on strong in the last couple weeks, only third at conference, but then third at NCAA Nationals, and now the trials against the best. The first 2 miles, the pack stayed tightly together. Then, with 1 mile to go, reminiscent of Pre's surge at the Munich final, Billy took off, and the pack hesitated, and then broke up and began stringing out. 20,000 people came to their feet. Jim and I left our seats and squeezed down against the rail against lane 8 at trackside. Billy's lead increased and increased. It was obvious that Billy would not have been able to kick with the likes of many in the field if he had waited it out. Taking off was his only strategy to break the others and make them chase him. But there was never any idea that he could hold them all off. Billy had 60 yards, but Centrowitz, the new American record holder in Berkeley, one of Pre's former closest rivals, were on the hunt. The question everyone knew now was, could Billy hold out long enough, or would he blow up on the track? As they hit the bell, one lap to go, Billy still had 30 yards, but his lead was crumbling. Right in front of us, in the middle of the backstretch, Centrowitz and Berkeley passed him like a relentless freight train. Billy's face was pulled back tight, his eyes fixated. Anyone who knew him well knew that he was beyond his limit, and the next 250 meters would potentially be bad. Could he make it, or had he gone out too hard and fast? Leaning over the edge, I was pounding on the wooden siding with the flat of my hand. I was yelling as loud as I could, but I couldn't hear my own voice. The place was coming apart with a roar. Billy hit the home stretch. His stride was reduced to a chop, his arms pumping maniacally with every effort to maintain form. Over in the West grandstands, Billy's father told me later, I had my head down below the seat. People were saying, you have to look. And I was yelling, I can't watch. I can't watch. Another runner was gaining fast. The gap was narrowing rapidly. Would the finish line come soon enough? But by about 2 strides, Billy hit the line first. 3rd place, and he was an Olympian. An Olympian without an Olympics to go to. After the finish line, he got down on all fours, bent forward in front of 20,000 people, and kissed the track. Then the 3 winners took a victory lap, and characteristically, in the middle of the backstretch, feeling relieved in front of the hometown crowd, Billy did a somersault. That summer at races in Europe, Billy beat both the eventual silver and gold medal winners, and then just before the games, he had to come home. The following year, he was ranked number 1 in the 5,000 in the country and number 4 in the world. And that year, he set a national NCAA collegiate record in the 5,000 that, to this day, has still never been broken. Matt and I took off on our bicycle trip, 6 weeks and 1,500 miles. In true form, we barely left the state of Oregon. We lived on $2.50 a day each for food and spent our evenings sitting beneath the nearest street lamp, eating cheap ice cream and reading to each other from the Grapes of Wrath. At times we would find time to meditate, but always separately. It would be many years before I learned about meditating with others. It seemed in the beginning to be a very private activity that you did alone. That winter, I transferred to the University of Arizona in Tucson. Part of my impetus to leave Eugene was tensions with my family. After my father had died, nothing seemed to work right anymore, and there was constant acrimony between myself, especially, and my sister. It was as though one of those scenes you see in movies where someone shoots the tail propeller on the helicopter and suddenly the machine starts spinning wildly out of control. Something had been removed from our family that was like the kingpin, and none of us, we found, actually related to each other very well. I needed to leave. And so I went to University of Arizona, where Jeff and a couple other runners were, and I walked onto the team. I completed out my eligibility at U of A, which was a personal goal of mine. to run Division I NCAA track in the Pac-10 Conference. Maybe I was never that good. I was injured a lot with the ankle, and I never got that many chances to compete. There were often differences and conflicts with our distance coach, Dave Murray, but the team was an incredibly supportive bunch of guys, and we'd always weather it through. And running every day in the Arizona sun through trails in the deserts and mountains was just the perfect antidote to years of slogging through the Oregon rain. One time, I found out about a sitting group of just four people or so connected, I think, with ZCLA at someone's house on the far side of town. Riding my bike for miles through suburban neighborhoods, I came to a tract home on a dead-end cul-de-sac. The furniture had been moved out of the wall-to-wall carpeted dining room, and I never remember two periods of meditation being so deathly quiet before or since. It was a good experience, but I was never going to make it back again. 70 miles a week of running, 5 miles a day of biking to and from classes, a full load of school, and a part-time job left no time or energy to repeat the crosstown evening excursion to the sitting group. One day, I was approaching the track for a workout, coming in from my usual warm-up mileage. There was a confusion going on over by the little concrete block garage we used for equipment storage. One of the sprinters was just bawling his head off and throwing himself across the hood of a car. People were trying to calm him. Somebody ran up to me and said, "Don't go over there. They just found Willie. He shot himself." Willie had gone out only 3 days before and got a gun, and for reasons nobody knows, came right here where he knew we would all find him and shot himself in the head. The funeral was huge, maybe 1,000 people. The procession of cars ran for over a mile down Speedway Boulevard in the sun. To this day, no one knows why he did it. Some of the guys believed, but I never saw much evidence, that some sort of underworld conflict was going on in Willie's life, something nobody knew about. Even now, years later, I recently said to an Arizona teammate, "You know about Willie?" And he just cut me off and said, "I don't want to talk about Willie." Well, finally, my eligibility ended, and I had one more year of school. I remember one time buying $200 worth of school books and then coming to the other part of the bookstore and buying another $200 of Buddhist and Eastern philosophy books, going home, throwing the school books in the corner, and just reading the other books for 2 weeks until it was apparent that I needed to hop to it and get back to schoolwork. I was a very unorthodox student. I was studying now general fine arts, emphasizing music, creative writing, and photography. And I had simply skipped most of the 100-level prerequisites for most of the areas I was studying. By my final semester of school, I had 6 100-level required courses I had never taken. And yet, I was currently taking all the 400 and 500-level courses. So I convinced the dean to waive 5 of the 6 required courses. I met in one of my poetry classes, my long time now, best friend, hiking friend, Rick, and spent many times hitchhiking together. I still didn't own a car, so getting back and forth to Oregon numerous times was basically by thumb. One time I sent Rick a Xerox of a topographic map with an X on it and said, "Meet me here an hour before sundown on such and such a date, high in the mountains in Oregon." He was hitchhiking all over the country, came in from the other side, and we did it. We met high in the mountains an hour before sundown. I think he was about 30 minutes late. One day I got one of those letters you hate to get from my mom, a newspaper clipping attached. Billy's oldest brother, Tom, had been killed, hit by a bicycle by a car in San Diego as he was rushing to a high school track and field awards banquet for a team he'd been helping coach. I wrote a letter to Billy's family, but in a situation like that, what can you say? After Pre, the specter of trauma around one who dies young just seemed to weigh more heavily in a situation like that for everyone I knew from Eugene. After running was over, and I was still in school, I had time for, shock, a girlfriend, which I had never had up to that point in time. Besides being a fellow art student, she was also a student at the local 3HO ashram, the Healthy, Happy, Holy organization, studying Kundalini Yoga. So, although the relationship ended halfway through the year when she graduated and went back home to her real boyfriend, a bad pattern for me that repeated a few times in my life, I was a pretty devoted Kundalini student for about a year. School ended, and I had assiduously avoided any kind of declaration about what it was I may be doing with my life. Instead, I decided to go to my fallback, the bicycle. I packed up what little belongings I had and left them with friends, packed to be shipped if needed to be to somewhere else, if that's what it turned out to be. I put what I needed on the bicycle, including my I Ching, which I would use at crossroads in the hinterlands to determine if perhaps I would go left or right. I resolutely decided not to decide where it was I was going, told my mother, I would not be calling for at least a couple of months, and I took off. 10 days later, after crossing canyons, heat exhaustion, this was July, mountains, and a trackless 3-day stretch of sagebrush on the eastern margin of the Navajo Reservation, I came to the foot of the Jemez Mountains in northern New Mexico. In the age before the internet, before I had left, I had gone to the university library to find out whatever old and outdated information I could about spiritual communities and such along the way, and I had the name of a place, Jemez Bodhi Mandala, but no address. Maybe it was around here somewhere. I stopped at a little dusty 2-pump gas station at the crossroads and went in to buy a Snickers bar, completely under the pretext of being able to ask, so, is there a Buddhist monastery around here somewhere? And the guy said, yeah, just 10 miles up the road. I spent a few days there, and this is where I met my now ex-wife, Jackie. They were staging a month-long seminar for massage practitioners, and she was attending there from Vermont. So a few days later, I left to continue my journey, but now somehow magically transported right into a fully-fledged, committed relationship, pretty much the last thing I'd been thinking to find. I continued to Santa Fe, then up through Colorado. Now, this is part of my trip that definitely falls into the don't try this at home, kids, category. Going south to north through the Colorado Rockies on a fully loaded bicycle, I crossed the Continental Divide 6 times in 8 days, camping at 5,000 feet each night and each day going over passes that were 10, 11, even 12,000 feet. I planned to rendezvous with Jackie in Boulder, but the day before, I found myself getting very sick with intestinal flu and needing to scale the biggest pass yet over Rocky Mountain National Park. I'd been sick like this once before, a week after Pre died, when I was 15. They had thought it was appendicitis and had taken out my appendix only to find it was intestinal flu. I'd been in the hospital for a week. Now, clutching my little bottle of Pepto-Bismol, I crept up and up, higher and higher, barely feeling like I could move, until just as I was breaking out into the alpine and stunning vistas, the sickness just fled from my body and was gone. I rocketed down 40 miles down the other side and into Boulder, right with the evening light. For the next 3 days, I basically blew all my money, bed and breakfast, rented a car, went out to sushi. And then standing there, literally, with one nickel in my pocket, putting Jackie on the bus to leave, I felt this sick queasiness start up again deep in my gut. And I suddenly knew I was not in a very good situation. I went around town a bit, trying to find some help, but neither Naropa or a church I went to would take me in. Feeling that I had to take evasive action and realizing that Boulder could perhaps be an unfriendly place to a penniless, sick wayfarer, I took what energy I had left and made my way a couple miles up Boulder Canyon, set up my tent, got inside, and proceeded to get very, very sick. 3 days later, I staggered out of my tent, standing upright for the first time, and there on the road above was a hitchhiker, and he called down, "Hey, friend!" It was Donald Brandt, 12 years on the road, Vietnam vet, a PTSD classic case, I suppose, antisocial, but good with me, one-on-one. Donald had run some sort of scam on food stamps in town and had got $75 worth. And he had gone to the store and bought up the only thing he considered worth anything to eat, which was Top Ramen. He had $75 worth of Top Ramen in his huge backpack, which was, coincidentally, pretty much the only thing I could really eat. You know, a little soft noodles, a little miso, and it was good. Donald basically nursed me back to health for a week. And then I went to working temporary labor in town, and we basically lived there for 3.5 weeks up Boulder Canyon until the cops kicked us out. While hanging out in Boulder, I was down on the Pearl Street Mall one day, and along came a whole band of Hare Krishnas. And I decided I was going to sort of check out their scene. And went over and started chanting with them. And it turned out that they offered food at their house a couple times a week for free. And you eat as much as you want, because the more you ate, the better it was for you spiritually. I thought, this is a pretty good deal, especially for me. So I started hanging out with the Hare Krishnas a lot. And I got Donald to come into town one day, encouraging him on the idea that he could get a really good meal. But when Donald and I showed up one day at the Hare Krishna house, they made us leave because he was such an unsavory character. But he was my friend, so I didn't go back. Eventually, I broke down my bike and shipped it and hitchhiked out to Vermont, where Jackie was. I had a map of the whole U.S. I would use when hitching to make sure I was making the connection with a road in one state that would end me up where I needed to go in another state. It was all torn in pieces, and I had to lay it all out just to see where the hell Vermont was, because I didn't know. We lived there for 4 years. I did carpentry mostly. We lived for a good chunk of that time up on top of a mountain on 80 acres in a funky hippie-built geodesic dome for, I think, $230 a month. Jackie was practicing with a Native American and Tibetan spiritual teacher named Dahani Oahu. For a summer, we actually lived at her spiritual community, Sunray. Through Jackie, I somehow got ushered in without the prerequisite trainings through the back door, so to speak, and before I knew it, I was kind of on the inside of the inner circle of this organization. Even so, it was never easy to relate to Dahani in any sort of normal way. She was radiant in an almost unapproachable way and clearly clairvoyant. She seemed to always know everything that was going on in your mind. She also communicated with her students predominantly in the dream state. And there were many times I would have lucid dreams where Dahani would approach me and say something very pointed and clear relating to my life. I found it very enticing and all a bit unnerving at the same time. The practices were very powerful chakra-based chanting and meditation systems handed down through a Cherokee family lineage, and also Tibetan and Korean Buddhist practices she had been empowered to teach. Eventually, however, the lack of being able to have a normal conversation sort of made the relationship break down, and we moved from Sunray to the dome. The relationship with Dahani drifted away. I do still consider her my first teacher, though, in a way that you make that special connection with someone in your life. We got married outdoors at the dome, and then immediately went off on a graduate program in environmental education with the National Audubon Society Expedition Institute, a traveling consensus-based school run out of converted school buses that spanned all over North America. Over 2 years, we traveled from the northern tip of Newfoundland to the southern tip of Florida, to Washington State, and to the Southwest, and everywhere in between. But just a few weeks into the program, Jackie's dad had a particularly horrible suicide, taking a rifle to Jackie's mom's lawyer's house, dealing with the impending divorce, shooting out all the windows, and then himself right on the front lawn. We had to leave and go through a very sad process for a week and then right back out onto the road. On the Audubon School, we had three-person A-frame style Eureka tents. I always elected to take the middle position, which, being the least favored, was an easy sell, but it was also the only place with full headroom sitting height, and I would set my watch a half hour early each day and sit zazen between my tent mates. At times on the school, we had breaks where the bus would just let us off somewhere for a couple weeks and we had to fend for ourselves. One time, we spent a week at Araloka in New Hampshire, a small retreat center connected with the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order. Another time was in San Francisco. So we stayed at City Center for 5 days, then hiked down from Mount Tam through the coastal chaparral and into Green Gulch for another 5 days. It was perfect to do a half-day guest student schedule and then have the rest of the day to do our schoolwork. While in the city, I met up with Jim, who was living there now and working for an architectural firm. Jim had been growing over the years a bit more sullen and depressive, but he told me a strange story. He had had a fender bender accident and bumped his head, so he was taken in for observation. Nothing was wrong from the accident, but in examining his forehead, they found he had a pituitary gland malfunction that was probably causing his mood issues. So he had very recently started drug therapy to counterbalance the hormone problem and was looking forward to how it might help. At Green Gulch, this time, was when I first encountered Norman in a lecture class, and I quickly took note that here was someone who really seemed to be a good fit for me. Also, on the final evening at Green Gulch, Jackie and I sat down to dinner at a table with a guy with sort of long hair about down to here and a big red beard named Tim, and had a very good conversation. It was sort of one of those small world moments. You don't ever think you're going to see somebody like that again, because why would you? We were headed from there directly to the Southwest, and Tim was, I wasn't even sure where he was from. There were people from many places there. While on the school, I had been reading the book The Mind of Clover by Robert Aiken. It was one of those books that I would read, and then when I got to the end, I would turn it right over and start reading it again. And I did that maybe about 4 times with that book. It inspired me to see if there was some group in the Pacific Northwest where I was feeling like we wanted to move back. I wanted to move back there and had been discussing with Jackie doing that. If there was some group there that was practicing in that tradition. So I got on the phone and called Hawaii and called Kokoan and asked, and they said, yeah, sure. And they gave me some names of people in Seattle. And on one of our breaks from the school, we went to Seattle and met with people, and they gave us names of some people in Bellingham, Jack Duffy and Ian Kira. And we came to Bellingham for a few days, which was not a town that I even knew existed before then. I'd only been to Washington State briefly once before. And we decided to move here and got a place to rent almost sight unseen, went away for another couple months to finish things, and then drove out here and began living in Bellingham. And it turned out that Jack and Ian were actually just about to do a large remodel on their house, so I instantly had a job. I practiced for 5 years with Three Treasures Sangha in Seattle, going down monthly for all-day sittings, and occasional session at Camp Indianola on the Kitsap Peninsula. And I was a member of a teacher search committee because they were had got to a point where they were essentially teacherless and hunting for somebody to guide their sangha. It ended up being Jack. But my role on the committee was to sort of advocate for Norman. And I began a correspondence with Norman based around that. And that was how we first got to know each other. But Norman declined, saying, I don't think that I'll ever really be able to have enough time to come up to the Northwest with any regularity. Well, year and a half or so after we moved to Bellingham, I was doing environmental education for the county parks, and I needed to hire somebody to help run a day camp, and I hired this guy, Tim. Now, when I was on the Audubon School, they required us to be clean-shaven and have our hair cut above our ears because we looked pretty suspect anyway in the big hippie school bus, and they wanted us to be acceptable on Indian reservations and all sorts of places we would go. And you know how Tim looked at Green Gulch. Well, in Bellingham, we each looked different, somewhat similar actually. Short beards, medium length hair. The kids would always get us confused. Bob, Tim, Bob. They'd come running up to us. We'd been working together a couple weeks, and he gave me a ride in his car one day, and I got in the passenger side, and there was a sticker, a caricature of Bodhidharma, an ink drawing on his glove box, and I said, Bodhidharma. And he said, Bodhidharma Daosho. A little Zen code. And I looked at him and I said, have we met before? So Tim started put out these little flyers. They were about this big, a quarter sheet. It said something like Zen meditation. And he had a little glassed-in front porch on the house he lived in on Harris Street with enough room for maybe three Zabatons. And that was the beginning of the Bellingham Zen practice group. I would come when I could, which was maybe about half the time. The other half of the time I would call and say, Tim, I'm calling to say I can't come. Because I was living out of town and I had just bought a farm, which we called Hawk Meadow. where I still live, and had a baby on the way, and was practicing with another group. But eventually, the transition happened. As Norman began coming up for retreats, I just started sitting with this group, and things shifted with Three Treasures, and I sort of stopped sitting with them. In 92, my son Forrest was born. But about a month or so later, I got another one of those letters from my mom, newspaper clipping. Billy had died in a car wreck going over the Coast Range. He was rushing to get to a cross-country meet where he was going to be the honorary starter. I called up Jim, who was living in Portland now, and asked him if he would go with me down to Eugene for the funeral. And he said, "I just can't bear to go. But will you go? Will you write me a letter? I want you to tell me about it." So I went down. We were at the same church where I had been a few years ago when Billy got married. And all the guys were there. A lot of people I hadn't seen for a number of years. But it's really pretty much the worst time for any kind of reunion vibe. It was hard to even talk to people, and I kind of kept to myself. His brother Steve spoke. P.T. spoke. They were pallbearers. We went up to the cemetery. They had the casket on a stand. It was right as the Willamette Street begins to rise on the edge of town heading towards the Butte. Standing there, I kind of had a little discussion with Billy. I remembered a run we had taken that year, his last year in high school, in the fall, one of those bright fall days, with one other guy from our team, Seth Brown. And we were just about at this point, right here in front of the cemetery, when only a mile from the school, and I was feeling sluggish. And I even think I said, "I think I'm going to turn back," because we had decided we were going to run around the Butte, which was a pretty long haul. And we were facing the 3 mile uphill coming up over the shoulder, and I wasn't feeling up to it. And Billy offered me the hem of his t-shirt and said, I'll tow you up. And which is remarkable for a guy who's 5'3 and 110 pounds, you know. So laughing pretty much the whole way, he towed me up the 3 mile hill, and by that point I felt good. We ran around the Butte. We came back to Billy's house, got something to drink briefly. We'd gone 11 miles, and we were feeling so good, we said, "Let's head out to the community college." And we went up over the 30th Street Hill and out around the East Hills and did another 11 miles. Coming into the school, in the shades of the night coming down, we'd done 22 miles. It's my longest run ever. And I kind of thought about that moment of him towing me up the hill as being some sort of pantomime, sort of fun pantomime of the little desperation we would have in the exchange zone later that year when I could barely get the baton to him. Well, somewhere around this time, history's a little foggy, but I was pretty depressed. I was in therapy a lot through all those years. And I was on antidepressants for about 5 years. And there was some idea that my issues with ADD were still around, even though as a child I never really believed it. The idea back then was that you outgrew it at puberty, so I figured I didn't have it, and if I did, I don't have it anymore because they say you're done with it. And now they're saying, oh, well, maybe you have it. So after at least a year of not wanting to, I finally was convinced to try Ritalin again. And it took a few years for me to realize that there actually really was nothing wrong with me. And I had to go into my therapist and say, you know what? I'm not depressed. I just think I am. And I quit the medications and never really felt any different one way or the other through the whole thing. '95, my mom died, and within the space of 2 months, also Uncle David and both of the great aunties died. And in the wake of that, my sister, who was still living at home, and dealing with some of that stuff, probably out of the sense of that she sort of dealt with it when my dad was in that spot and dealt with it when my mom was in that spot, just got fed up with me, my brother, and she has never spoken to us since. At the same time, I had a number of injuries. I had a head concussion at work, a back injury, and then one day, after 10 years of really no problems, suddenly, for almost no reason, the ankle just sort of gave up the ghost, and the ligament severed, and I had to go get surgery. Not very long after that, Jackie and I got divorced. And somewhere not too long after that, I sort of fell prey to one of those predatory lenders who's got a scam loan and lost about $20,000. So life really wasn't going very well. But sometimes things that aren't going well just get worse. I bumped into an old Roosevelt friend in Bellingham who had been living here. And she was best friends with PT's sister. And she said, you know Paul, right? And I go, yeah. Did you know that Paul's dying? I go, no. What do you mean? He goes, well, he's got AIDS. What do you mean he's got AIDS? He goes, well, Paul's gay. I didn't know Paul was gay. I got hold of Jeff. Jeff told me, yeah, Paul's gay. I thought you knew that. I go, no, I mean, nobody ever told me. And he said, well, I know because Paul told me that he had a big crush on me all through high school. And that's why he dated my sister. I got hold of Jim again. The funeral was in Portland. So this time, Jim came along. And it was really nice. It was in a park overlooking the city, a really sort of joyous celebration of life type of event that I think was what really had to be happening for people in the gay community around that period of time. So many people were dying. You couldn't just have dark and doldrum type funerals. If so many people were dying, you had to affirm life. Jim and I were the only two people from back in the day in Paul's life who were there. So I felt really good that we had showed up and could contribute a little bit about the Paul we knew from back then. But then I also got to know other parts about Paul. Paul had been a triathlete. Paul had been a male model. Paul had been Nike's absolutely perfect size medium. They would call him in whenever they needed to tailor a new set of sweats or rain suit, and they would tailor it exactly for Paul, and that would fit everybody else in the entire world who was size medium. But about a year later, I got a call from one of the old South Eugene teammates. And Jim had been found dead in his apartment. He had apparently the pituitary gland issue was a little touchier than he led on to me to believe. And sometime over the weekend when he was living alone, something had gone awry with the chemistry, and he hadn't been able to get help, and he'd passed away. And I can't remember what it was. You know, I want to think it was something like snow, and I had sheep who were having lambs, and I was living alone or something, but for some reason I didn't go to the memorial. But I think the real reason was that this time I couldn't bear to go. One time I would get back down to the beach every once in a while. Every few years I'd get back down there. But I had been having, since my sister hadn't been talking to me, I had my mom's ashes. And I hadn't done anything with them because I thought, you know, we should do something together, but she didn't talk to me, you know. So it took about 5 years, and finally I decided, well, I guess I've got to do something anyway. So I got together with my brother and took my son down, and we went to the beach, and we went back to the cabin, which my brother had owned after my mom died for a while, but he had to sell it. So we ended up renting it from whoever owned it. And we spread the ashes in the ocean. And I built a really beautiful wooden urn that we burned on the beach. And in the last moments of burning it, this fluorescent green light came out of the middle of it and just stayed there for a full minute. And we had no idea what it could have been. Another time, a few years later, going down to the beach, heading to the cabin with a girlfriend, stopped into the Copeland's lumber store at the edge of town, a couple miles from the cabin, to pick up something I knew I needed there, and said to the girl at the counter, hey, has John Pound been around recently? And she just blanched, and she told me that John had shot himself a couple weeks before, that he had cancer. And I never really found out any other details. I didn't really want to know any other details. And then a few years after that, going down to the beach again with another girlfriend, trying to go to the cabin again, but hadn't been able to call anybody who still owned it, and so we just got a different place to rent. But I thought I'd show it to her. And drove right by where it was, missed it, came back, and found out that some developer had bought up a bunch of cabins in that row and torn them down to the ground and had built this ugly shoebox of a thing where the cabin used to be. So it's gone. Well, around that time that I was getting divorced and all of this, I basically was having a pretty hard time, and Norman sort of went to bat for me, and it was the very first year that they did the January practice period at Green Gulch, and I thought that would be a good thing if I just got out of town and went down there. So I think you needed some sort of prerequisite, but he sort of squeezed me in the door at that point, and that was a good time to be able to be there and practice. And that was where I met Michael Newton from Vancouver, because Michael sat right next to me all month, and also we were on the same work crews and had all the same schedule, basically. So that brings us up close to the present. A couple years ago, you probably would be interested to know, we there was a South Eugene Track reunion. It was a surprise for Harry Johnson on his retirement from Nike. He thought he was going to meet two or three people for dinner, but instead there were 200 athletes from the 70s who met him for a huge banquet. And we took all the old Super 8 movies that he took of us running and converted them to DVDs and had them playing up there. And Steve, Billy's brother, spoke first. And I remember the very first thing he said was, "Who are all those little kids up there?" Because we did, you know. We thought of ourselves as men, but boy, we just looked like little teenagers. And I remember I spoke. They had all the team captains from the different years speak. And one of the things I remember saying was, you know, this is really great because, you know, we never get to talk about these years in our lives today because, you know, who wants to hear about your glory days in high school sports? The track at South Eugene got refurbished. Jeff is the coach there now. And he did a huge $500,000 fundraising campaign. So the track that when I first ran on it in seventh grade that was cinders, and then that Harry first surfaced with rubberized asphalt, where we set all the national records, has been refurbished now. And it's the Tom and Bill McChesney Memorial Track. And it's become an integral part of the new era of Olympic trials in Eugene, because as part of their bid for the trials, they include the idea that the South Eugene track will be the practice track for all the athletes. So that's been a really nice turn of events, but I think it took at least 10 or 12 or more years after Billy's death for us to be able to all come together again that way. It just took a long, long time. And now we can talk about those people, but for a long time it felt just too hard. Well, that's pretty much the end of my talk. Thanks for allowing me to take a lot of extra time than maybe some people do with these talks. I felt like I had a lot of things to say. So I hope it was okay. I hope it was good to hear. And I feel especially honored Jacobine Chusso for this group. This is a really special group, and it feels like we're in a really special time of building a really strong sangha. So thank you.